Alive. It is 10:30 a.m. on the West Coast, 1:30 p.m. on the East Coast. That means it's Value After Hours. I'm Tobias Carlyle, joined as always by Bill Brewster and Jake Taylor. What's happening, fellas?
Hola, amigos. How we doing? And Bill left. Perfect. We're off to a hot start.
Speaking of Bill just jumped out. I didn't see that. I was preparing something out the window.
He dropped for a second. He'll be back, I'm sure.
It was Chilean Independence Day yesterday. Oh. So
what'd you do to celebrate if you observe?
Empanadas and some Casillero del Diablo.
That feels like
Sananas.
Bill's back.
Can't see me.
That sounded a little like appropriation to me there. TC,
Chilenas. Chilenas gotta celebrate.
Okay.
Played some Chilean music. Hmm. Chilean national anthem.
I listened to our recording.
Was it?
And horrible? I can understand why people didn't love the recording quality, but I think some of you, at least 7 of the 10, are like a little picky on what you're expecting out of us. So just to reset, we are not professionals, folks. Okay.
Well, not in podcast production.
We're at the beach, and we did the best we could.
It was an experiment.
We thought we'd have a slightly better setup. No, not pointing fingers here. Just saying that, we were swimming upstream, and you even got the behind the scenes footage of my iPad and my backpack. So there's that. Maybe got to eavesdrop on a Morgan Housel, Jake Taylor, Bill Brewster, Tobias Carlyle conversation. So you're welcome.
That's a good one.
Didn't deserve to listen anyway. So
there were 25 people still listening at the end there.
Oh, yeah. God. I hope that didn't make it to the live, did it?
Far more people than showed up in person.
I have re-uploaded with the audio from
the real good recording.
Yeah, from the better recording.
Maybe that's the problem. I listened today.
Yeah, so that would have been the new one.
Okay, good.
Well, maybe you people aren't as picky as I thought. We were up against Caribbean. Gunlock. Not the best draw in the world.
Yeah. That's going to make it tough for us to get any asses in the seats.
And he was wearing yellow. But shout out to Porter Collins for stopping by. Very cool dude. We got to meet with him. And was it Vince?
Yeah, Vince Daniels.
Yeah. Nice guy.
Danny Moses.
Yeah. Big short. Kind of nice.
Shout out to them for choosing us over Gunlock, if out of pity. We appreciate y'all.
So that was the highlight, seeing having a chat to the Seawolf guys, because they are brothers from another mother.
Did we have a chat to them, or did they have a chat to us, or did we just chat with each other?
A little bit of both.
It was consensual, Bill.
Yeah, it was consensual. I don't know if social it would have been, had it just been me, I maybe would have forced myself into the conversation, but with the veil of you two, it was consensual.
I don't know how much we were saying. I think we were mostly listening, but we were chatting.
Yeah. Good. Shout out to Mary. Thanks for saying that you listen. Shout out to all the ladies.
Both of them?
I think there might be 4.
Okay.
hopefully more. But 4 out of 10 is pretty good percentage there.
We should give a shout out to Niall for inviting us. He's a good friend and a good dude. Thanks, Niall.
Yeah, thanks, Niall. That was fun.
He's a good dude.
Yeah. All right, let's
I
get
like
into
the beach. It's kind of a better vibe nice. Than we have going on right now.
Yeah.
Alas.
Wow. That was cool. What do you got up on deck today, Jake?
A little dramatic foreshadowing with my background, which is that's a Vermeer painting. So we're going to have
earring.
Yes, correct. Good job, TC.
Thank you.
You probably just saw the movie with Scarlett Johansson.
Oh, I just saw it was a girl with a pearl earring. I was literally just
just saying what I see. So we're going to do a little art forgery, actually. So that might be kind of fun. So we'll get into that.
Cool.
What you got?
Nice.
Jake's pulling double duty today. He sent me an article beforehand, but it's a good one. I would have found it eventually, because I do like these guys. Sean Stannard Stockton has written Equity Duration Inflation, looking at some of the Nifty 50 stocks from, everybody knows that the Nifty 50 stocks were like, you had to buy them in the, there was no price that you couldn't pay that was too high. And then they
one decision snapped. Stocks. They
one decision the stocks. That's right.
That was what Never Sell used to be called.
Right. That was back in the 70s. And then they had a fall from grace and they were smashed up through the 70s. But as everybody now knows, the coda to that story finally is that they were all such good businesses that they did finally outgrow the overvaluation. And so I wasn't entirely sure what date they were referring to, but by 1998, which was again another pretty famous stock market peak. So I guess you can call it there, but
peak to through cycle is what they say.
Through cycle.
That's fair. They had, they'd returned about 12%. They'd done about market perform. So he draws some interesting conclusions from that. So I'm going to talk about that a little bit.
You just don't want to have to sell anytime in those 30 years. And you want to have faith that you're right.
You wanted to buy more, I think, as they got really beaten up because they were good businesses. Right.
Yeah. Never mind the fact that you may have lost your job.
Yeah.
Yeah, that can be an unfortunate side effect.
Right.
Do you mean as a manager or just generally as an investor?
Oh, I think just generally.
Yeah.
Well, maybe as just a, you know, regular working person in the late 70s, early 80s, that was kind of a rough economic period.
Yeah.
I mean, definitely as a manager, you got redemptions.
Yeah.
There's no way 7 years into that, you're like telling your LPs,
it's still
just
a good business.
Me. That's right. You don't understand. Such a good business. Yeah. We're just on the wrong side of multiple compression.
I just need rates to get a little lower.
That's right. That works out for the first 2 years or 3 years or four, but seven is too long.
Before we sort of embark on that thing, do you think that that is a good corollary for today?
I don't know.
I mean, it's just a stock market peak. Like I 70, like that's that peak, and then the one in the late 1990s, and then I guess again today, they all sort of seem similar-ish, right?
Well, but on the other hand, Microsoft was trading at like 60 times earnings, right? In 99. This time it's 30. I mean, that is half.
Yeah.
Half does matter.
What was it peak? What was its peak?
But it's a lot bigger now.
Yeah, what did revenue look like in 99 versus today?
Yeah, I mean, it's a much better business now, or bigger.
Do you want to do this one now? Because there are some interesting... He makes some interesting comments about the PEs. So Nifty 50, 1970s, the names that he pulls up, Coke, P&G, Johnson & Johnson, Disney, Amex, Pfizer. As a cohort, they had a PE of 42 average versus 19 for the S&P 500. So they were more than twice what the market was. And so he says it's not fair to characterize it as a bubble that burst because they did, from that peak, they went on to generate 12% compound.
Well, that's a PE that they're measuring, right? Which,
right,
that's not like 50 times sales or some of these other things.
Yeah, that's got a bottom line. I mean, that's one of the things that if you constrain a universe to things that have got a bottom line, then you...
Maybe. Just wanted to point out that, you know, there are other levels universe to that game as well, as far as some stuff that got expensive.
Two, if you could constrain a universe to things that have free cash flow and you're doing it off a free cash flow multiple, then again, you know, you've constrained that universe even more. Like those are just by virtue of the fact that you require some free cash flow, you've eliminated a lot of stocks that you probably don't want to hold. But then he breaks out, he's got this interesting analysis where he says, looking at, there are three drivers of returns: earnings growth, your beginning PE and your ending PE, and any dividend that you collect along the way. So he says year one, say $1 of earnings with a PE of 25, that's a $25 stock. And year 10, assuming that earnings grow 10% per annum, 10% per year, which that's a pretty high rate of growth. Yeah. But these are pretty good companies that collectively had done something like that. So you get to 259 in earnings in year 10. He assumes that you get this multiple compression from 25 to 20. And you end up with a $51.80 stock when you started with a $25 stock. And so your compound return is 9%. Did you just do that off the top of your head?
No, I knew it. I was just I did a Buffett where you already knew the answer, but you pretend like you were doing the math in your
head. Good one. And so he concludes that at 25 times, that stock was fairly valued because it then went on to deliver a market return. And if it had been a PE of 16, same stock, you would have had a 14.7% compound return over that period, which would have outperformed the market and so would have indicated that it was too cheap. If it had been a PE 35, that would have been 5% per year and so overvalued. And so he says that PE 25 was a fair value PE because it delivered a market return. And then he looks at two specific examples. Costco from 2002 to 2015 had a PE of 15. And it delivered 15 to 20% returns through that whole period. And fair value for Costco would have been a PE 40. And at that 40 would have delivered only 9% a year. And then he gives the example of Coke too. So Coke in 1972 had a PE of 46 and it still went on to deliver 16.2% compound through that period. And I think Buffett paid like 22 times, right, for Coke. You guys remember that? Off the top of your head,
was it that much in the late 80s is when he bought most of it, right? It was kind of after that new Coke snafu, and I think it might have sold off some when he backed the truck up, but I don't remember.
My recollection it was 22 times, but that might be wrong. Somebody in the audience might know that. And then
Bill might know it. He looked like he's.
Do you know? No, I don't. I don't know. Didn't they also have that movie studio at the time?
There was all kinds of capital allocation.
So I don't know what is look through
shenanigans going on. But on this sort of analysis where you say the market does X, so 9%, and then let's look at the PE that would have delivered a 9% return. So he says that fair value for Coke in 1972 was an 82 PE. It would have delivered 9% returns. So at 46, 16.2%. Big outperformance. He's got some other conclusions about probably what happens in the interim. So he's like, for a decade, you get if inflation spikes, all of these long duration type stocks that have got the high PEs probably get smashed up. But there's a chart that he includes from Jeremy Siegel that shows how vastly undervalued they were by 1982, which is what then delivered the incredible run through to 2000 and probably where they got overvalued near the end there. So I thought it was kind of an interesting analysis. I've seen it before in relation to, I think it was Walmart. They worked out what you could have paid in Walmart to get a market return from the
early 70s or something.
Yeah. And it was something. It was a lot. It's like 1,000 times or something like that.
Yeah. Got to be able to build a lot of boxes if you're going to pay that multiple.
That's the thing. I mean, if you're right about these businesses, then fair play to you. I think you deserve to do well, but gosh, if you're wrong about any of them, the downward, like the cliff you fall off of is pretty steep.
Yeah, I think it's easy in theory to say like, oh, well, these are non-correlated bets, right? Like, what does Walmart have to do with Coke or something like that? But if they're all in the same factor or whatever, from a portfolio construction perspective, you could have some real drawdowns. It's probably what it really probably is an argument against style drift. Like if you're going to be a quality guy, you should probably stay quality throughout. Much like value guys probably should have stayed value throughout. Right. So
let's think about the businesses that came in that list that became these juggernauts. Like what, I think there's a few things that maybe we can unpack that we can try to see, does that make them then a good corollary for today? I would say, you know, some of them are in the CPG space, which my understanding is that because we had this like very narrow, tight pipeline of media where you had like three channels, basically, there was a return to scale of advertising that you could do to build your name if you were Tide or Crest, you know, or one of these, you know, staple kind of home, you know, Procter & Gamble now owns you type of brands. And they got big because you couldn't advertise in a million different places. There was only certain places where you could actually get the eyeballs. And it was because we only had three channels. Well, with the internet, that completely explodes that, like the direct to consumer goods completely explodes that CPG little anomaly in the matrix where you could like build a brand to an extreme level where you could charge 2x what everyone else was charging and people would be willing to pay for it because it wasn't that big share of wallet and you just want to go with the brand that you know, right? Tide or whatever. So that's a little bit of an anomaly historically, I would say. Whether that repeats today, I'm not sure. Some of these other ones were definitely like huge beneficiaries of a rapidly globalizing world. Where, you know, from the 1980s onward, we just saw tremendous amounts of globalization, which allowed for, the profitability of businesses to really get into some kind of extreme places that they couldn't have gone before, with their input costs being kept down.
That was Buffett's thesis for Coke, right? That it didn't have any international saturation at all. Might have been saturated in the US, but it had lots of places to go internationally.
Right. So if you are the believer of that maybe globalization might have peaked and we're going backwards, or at least the pendulum swinging backwards for a while the other way, which I don't know, like if you just look at war as a proxy, that's, you know, it's certainly, I think things are a little more geopolitically fraught today than they were the last 5 or 10 years. So if you believe that, then it seems like it might be harder to have that kind of global-led growth that you experienced in the 80s and 90s. I don't know. Like, I'm not sure how good the corollaries are. I'm sure I'm missing something important that makes this obvious. But
there's not a lot of tech in there. That's one of the interesting things from the names that they threw out: Coke, P&G, Johnson & Johnson, Disney, Amex, Pfizer. I mean, Pfizer's tech-ish, I guess, because it's pharma, but Costco too, not particularly technological. That's missing Microsoft, of course, and Google today.
Them, yeah, IBM is IBM on that list?
I
think they were.
Probably they were, but not in the article. To what extent is this resulting?
I don't know. I mean, I think if you look at a basket, I don't know that it's any more resulting than looking historically at value and saying value should work. It's just kind of a different way to look at it and extend your time horizon, but it's definitely picking top to top. And I do think that, you know, you gotta ask yourself if you really believe it, you know, can I live through an extended drawdown of underperformance and not?
I mean, let's talk about how long that styles. We're talking like a decade, 7 to 10 years. That's virtually impossible, I would say.
Well, yeah, and this wasn't 7 to 10 years. This was what, 30?
Yeah, to get back to break even.
To get back to 99, yeah. Right, or 98.
It was early 70s to 98. Yeah, that's a long time.
Or two, right? So,
but you were outperforming. Like the first 8 years sucked, and then you were kind of outperforming thereafter.
How many clients do you have after 8 years?
None.
And how much trust do you have in yourself if you underperform after 8 years?
None.
So, you know, I think that's the relevant question.
I'm going to bet you 12 and counting at the
front. Telling me there's a chance.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a very real question to ask, because it's one thing to read something in a textbook or, you know, look at it. And I mean, he's objectively right. You know, there's no way to argue with what he's saying, but living that is different.
Well, you had Coke at 46, and then when Buffett's buying it, I think somebody said 18. Salil said 18 times in 89. So 20 years later, the PE is more than halved. That's tough. Yeah.
Well, you know, you get earnings growth and stuff.
Underlying business would be great. I mean, I've seen all of that in real time from. The ones that stand out to me, because I was buying them in 2015, is like Walmart. A few of those sort of names, I'm just blanking on a few of them, but they were so beaten up. They were so expensive in 2000. It took them until 2015 to catch up to get to fair value, or to get undervalued in 2015. And people didn't want to touch them because they hadn't done anything for 15 years. Like the stock price hadn't
dead
done anything
money.
For 15 years. Yeah, dead money.
The other thing that sucks, man, is on those, I mean... What did you say Coke was as an entry multiple?
46 in 72.
Okay, so you're making like 2%, 2.2%, 2.1, something like that.
On the bottom line, yeah.
And then inflation ran at what?
5 to 15%.
Much higher.
Yeah. So like on a real basis, you were losing a lot of money through that decade.
Well, Volcker got interest rates to 20.
Yeah. Yeah. That sucks. Yeah. You know, I don't know how you, I mean, I think this is why a lot of the industry closet indexes. So you don't have to live with this kind of thing.
It might actually be... So let's talk about portfolio construction a second when we look at that result that came from there. If you took out the top five names out of that, I think you did pretty bad, actually. So there's this return profile that's generated that comes asymmetrically from the top performers. And so if you... This is a recommendation against concentration in this type of strategy, because you are almost guaranteeing that you are flipping a coin at zero or hero at that point, right? So, you know, if you're going to have these very asymmetric outcomes, you almost have to position size smaller and try to own a bunch of them so that you catch it. Otherwise, it's like it's game over. So you're taking tons of risk if you're concentrating in that.
Talking David Gardner, guy after my heart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because the right tail is so pronounced in these ones that win, that says to me that you're better off having lots of small positions.
Yeah.
You could get lucky and pick the one that wins and look like a genius, but if you want to be, your best case scenario is just keeping up with, you know, just having a little bit of it in your portfolio. So if it goes up 100 times, then it doesn't matter that it was only a few percent.
Yeah.
Doesn't it seem difficult though, that if you, from that starting point, if you catch all the winners, you end up with like market perform. Return. But if you don't, you're
under.
You're smoked. Like that seems kind of a scary game to play to me.
They're all scary games in the market. Yeah, but that's what I've learned.
What's your other alternative? S&P 500.
Yeah. Maybe. Right, and then you hide there.
Basket of dog crap.
Well, yeah.
There's some good names. Like if you were going to pick the next Nifty 50 to do that, it's probably in the S&P 500. It's already in the S&P 500. I don't know which ones it is, though. It's probably
it might be software.
Five.
You know what I thought was interesting is my man Exit Multiple on the Twitter machine. He posted an interview. It was a podcast of a company that was undergoing a SaaS transition. And you know,
they put you under for that.
What?
Do they put you under for that?
No. He's actually a value guy at heart, I believe. I don't want to curse him.
No, when they're giving you the SaaS transition, did they give you a general anesthetic? That's all I was asking.
No, I don't think so. I think you have to take it
you have to be
fully alive. But what he was saying is he said, like, you've got to convince these customers that you have, I'm pretty sure these were his exact words, that like what they're paying a dollar for today, they're going to want to pay $4 in the future for. So you've got to figure out how to deliver that value. And he was talking about how capital intensive, you know, the working capital transition is, right? Because you go from selling something for $90 to selling something for, I don't know, $6 a month or whatever, or $10 a month, whatever it is. And how much R&D goes into getting your product ready.
This is Adobe buying Figma. I mean,
well, and then he made the comment where he was like, he said something to the extent, my takeaway was like switching costs are much lower in that model. And that was kind of what got me perked up. So it's like, okay, so at least in that one company, I don't know. I mean, I know that people say it's a much more superior business model and I understand why they say it, but it seems like it's a more competitive, at least according to him and his particular company, it's a more competitive product that requires a higher sales process for something that's easy to switch on. That's not like the greatest pitch.
There's a good comment here that sorry, JT, you go and then I'll read this one up.
That's fine. I was just going to say that there's a little bit of a clue there in the name as software as a service. Like you're providing a service now on top of software. So there's like kind of this long tail of liability of delivering something as opposed to when they buy a one-off, you know, CD from you in a box and you upload it on your computer.
But you paid for it along the way. That's a better model, isn't it? Some expectation that you support the product long-term. Keep on. I like this. Ben DeMero says, isn't there a case to be made that the S&P 500 is the next Nifty 50? Like the Nifty 50 people will buy it at any price all of the time. That's that Michael Green flows argument. How do you feel about that?
Sounds right until it's wrong. And everyone wants to get out, and then what? I don't know.
When do people change that? I mean, I guess we're not through the, I don't know when the bust bottoms, but we're not through the bust yet, but we probably need to have a bust, right? Before we can make a decision.
I feel like that goes against, you know, thousands of years of human psychology and what has happened historically.
Hang on. Sorry. I have a construction person that just walked in. What is the question? My apologies. This is
still a thing.
Is there a case to be made that the S&P 500 is the next Nifty 50? Like the Nifty 50, people will buy it at any price all the time.
It's just not trading that high relative to the Nifty 50, right? I mean,
it's on 30 times. It's on 30 times. Sure.
What were we talking about? And when we were talking in the hotel lobby, like where we thought interesting bets were. I mean, exporting emerging markets, right? So, but man, I don't know. You got to be diversified in those bets and hope you catch a ripper. I think the U.S. is so much more robust than everywhere else that if you believe in deglobalization, there might be margin risk here, you know, like margin compression risk, but at least we're well equipped for war, and we can eat and have our own energy.
That's all important.
I feel like that kind of deserves to trade at a premium.
Agreed. Go ahead.
I had a couple of questions. This is from Samson. I guess if you got to pick the Nifty 50, give me three names. What's your three names for the ones that in 30 years time are still going strong, bigger?
Bill's smarter than me at this stuff.
Microsoft.
So go ahead.
Well, tech. Since it's Samson, we'll throw in Tesla for him.
How's that?
No, I don't know. I mean,
maybe Tesla. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, as the world exists today, it's pretty hard to argue Amazon? Against Apple.
Apple, Amazon.
Yeah, I mean, it'd probably be the TerraCaps.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's not a sexy answer, and I'm certain that there's
Costco.
You know, this camping world idea. I mean, I don't own any, and I'm like very lazy on my research on it. But you know, I could see a scenario where they consolidate over time and end up the big player.
Does Camping World have the big pyramid, or is that Bass Pro Shops? Bass Pro Shops, right?
Yeah,
I love that. I mean, that comic that does the rounds on the internet where they have that guy explaining to the Pharaoh that.
Yeah, what's another one? Ashteed, is that they're the auto group roll up, right? I think they are. I could see that doing pretty well, but that's not like Nifty 50 stuff. That's just kind of like share gainers.
Visa and MasterCard?
Yeah, probably. Obviously, blockchain's gonna undo all their stuff, but
it's over.
Bass Pro Shop must be a mighty pharaoh.
Yeah. I mean, we'll see. I don't know. Maybe Netflix.
This is the other one I wanted to ask. James L., what does it take to reverse on indexing?
I don't think it will.
I think that most people who index through their work don't know what's happening. Don't know that that's where the money's going.
Yeah, I think that's like actually probably a pretty nice way to live. Why would you want to reverse that?
At the end of the year, you get a note that says you're up or down, and you just like whatever. Don't worry about it when I retire.
You just got to focus on making more money next year and doing the same thing, and over time it'll work.
Yeah.
100% true. I don't know if that's the psychological path that often happens there, though. People get scared and they sell out. That's how you get to a bottom, right?
Yeah. The last bottom was a long time ago, though. It might be different. I don't know.
2009? Or is it like there have been a 2016, 2018,
color,
2020?
Those were color real. Me skeptical that everyone has the faith to like ride out through trauma.
I don't think it's faith so much as I think it's
structural.
Just inertia.
Yeah.
It's hard to change.
It's also really intelligent. I mean, there is the potential that like a lot of people that are indexing have actually figured something smart out.
Yeah.
And they just stick to it.
Yeah.
100%. It's just harder than it sounds when it's
grinding
you lower every single day,
if you're not watching it, well, you know, I'm suffering the same thing. So,
I mean, imagine owning cable. You'd have to be a moron.
Oh my God. Just kick me in the nutsack all day long.
Yeah, that's right. So I don't know. Owning individual companies is tough. Sticking to an index strategy is tough. There's all this shit stuff.
I was told it was just to the moon and you just enjoy, you bro down.
Yeah, a lot of that's gone away, hasn't it?
That's kind of gone away, huh?
I'll tell you what was an interesting interview was Druckenmiller was at Palantir. that was a pretty interesting. He was actually interviewing that guy about their business. And he did say that he thought that possible for 10 years of stagnant markets. But what I found interesting is he was doing VC in Palantir in 2008 or 2009. Turns out that was a pretty good time to do venture capital. So there's a reason.
What vehicle? Just him personally, or has he got some
family? I think it was him personally. Yeah. I'm not sure.
Does he have outside money these days?
I think he just runs a family office.
Yeah.
Smart.
Life is good.
He earned that.
No LPs.
Yeah. So, I don't know. That was an interesting interview. I also found my boy, The Science of Hitting. Hang on. I got to pull this up because it was a great quote from Klarman. And sorry, I don't have it ready, but it's something about how nervous he is. It says, I'm more worried about the world broadly than I've ever been in my career. I'd be worried we'll have another 10 years of zero returns. And that was an interesting quote from 2010.
Got us.
Yeah. So
you should. I'm glad you cut me off before I said anything.
It's not such an easy game.
To be fair, in 2010, I guess we'd bounced a little bit by then. Yeah.
So if Klarman can't get it right, there's not a chance I can.
Oh, that was Klarman. Yeah.
Yeah. Because that dude is
Druck.
Way, 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 way smarter than I am.
Yeah, that was the Shilopi got, like, we just bounced off fair value in 2009. And then we bounced a lot. So by mid-2010, it was already looking expensive on a Shilopi basis in a long time.
I mean, this could be total misremembering on my part, but I don't remember wanting for ideas in 2010, 2011. 2012,
yeah. Well, it felt cheap in 2012 too, I thought. Yeah.
Yeah. But who knows?
It's just that the names that were being pitched in 2012 were Microsoft.
Just dog shit like Microsoft in 2012.
An earnings yield with, not quite 2012.
Five times earnings, revenue had already rolled over. Made no sense.
Yeah.
There's some right now. They're out there. I don't know what they are. People find them. Feel free to send
them. People say that they're out there.
No, they're out there. They're definitely out there. They're probably in foreign markets, but they're out there.
Should we bang out some vegetables?
Let's do it.
All right.
Anyway, for real, check out that Palantir interview. I thought it was a good interview. Really interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, it's corporate propaganda, but, you know, they're talking about what they do.
Everything is.
Yeah.
Everyone's talking their book.
All right. So this is the story of the fake Vermeer. And, This guy named Abraham Bredius, I believe his name is. I could be mispronouncing that, and that's okay. He's an art critic and a collector, and he's one of the leading scholars on Dutch painters, particularly Johan Vermeer paintings. And as a young man in the 1880s, he made his name by spotting works that were wrongly credited to Vermeer. And so fast forward, he's 82 years old in 1937, and he publishes this book identifying 200 fakes and imitations of Rembrandts, right? He's like this master expert when it comes to what, you know, paintings are real and which aren't, and especially Dutch painters. And there's this newly discovered work that comes out that surfaced, and Bredius has ruled that not only is it a Vermeer, but he thought it was Vermeer's finest work. And his quote was, when this masterpiece was shown to me, I had difficulty controlling my emotions. Like, this dude he's into it. The painting soon after sold for $10 million equivalent at that time period. There were several more paintings that emerged in a similar style. And, you know, all these critics certified them, museums exhibited them, and more than $100 million of that time. And this is like in the 1930s, changed hands. There was only one problem. All of them were fakes. So May 1945, the Dutch authorities arrest this old man named Han Vermeeren, Van Meegeren, I think, or it might be Meegeren, I don't know. And they charge him with treason. And they accused him
treason.
They accused him of selling Dutch masterpieces to the Nazis, specifically to Hitler's right-hand man, Hermann Göring. So after a few days in jail, Van Meegeren, eventually he confesses, and he's actually gloating. And he says that he forged these paintings himself and he sold them to the Nazis. And he was so happy with himself. Yeah, that he'd fooled all these experts and the Nazis.
That doesn't sound like treason. That sounds like getting a bunch of money out of a country for a bunch of junk.
So you're getting there. So how did Bredius, who's this Vermeer expert, like no one knows Vermeer better than this guy, how did he get fooled? And ooh, maybe
can I hypothesize?
Please.
Is it because he wanted to find these things? It was like all motivated reasoning.
Oh my God, Bill, you're so good. You're ready.
Is that it?
You're ready to serve the veggies. You've ascended.
Student has become the teacher.
So Bredius's feelings were trumping his expertise, right? And so we have to rewind a little bit and go back into Bredius's history to understand this a little bit better. So in 1901, he ruled that this certain portrait wasn't a Vermeer. And it turned out that it actually was, and it stung his ego, and he didn't want to repeat that mistake again. And so he was likely looking for a chance at redemption. He's also especially fascinated by the religious works of Vermeer. And there was this gap in Vermeer's timeline where these paintings might have existed that were more of the religious nature. And so this one that came out, like actually Van Meegeren, he knew that, and he laid a trap, and he included lots of little touches that only Bredius was likely to notice. So for instance, like there's a simple test. Was the paint soft? Like, so apparently it takes 50 years for paint to dry fully. And so like, if they take like Vermeeren knew this and he did some amateur chemistry and he effectively added like this early plastic before the really plastics to resemble old paint, like it dried faster. And so younger paint would have dabbed off and revealed that it was a fake, but he passed it off this way. Bredius was very motivated to find another Vermeer, right? And so he was very emotional about it. By the way, all of this is from this book by Tim Harford, and it's called The Data Detective. There's a bunch of good stuff in there, but this is kind of the most interesting story that I got out of it. So apologies for stealing Tim's stuff without crediting him sooner.
This is a very good story.
Yeah, so the couple of quotes from Tim in this is, he says, "People with deep expertise are better equipped to spot deception, but if they fall into the trap of motivated reasoning, cue Bill, they are able to muster more reasons to believe whatever they really wish to believe." And then he says, "Today's persuaders don't want you to stop and think. They want you to hurry up and feel."
It's like politics, man.
Oh, totally. So Van Meegeren, as you foreshadowed, he pulled an even bigger stunt. He had made a ton of money during this Nazi occupation by selling paintings. In fact, he threw these like regular orgies with prostitutes while many Dutch people were starving, which is obviously not a good look. So the Dutch were feeling bad about this 5+ years of Nazi occupation. And Van Meegeren was the ringmaster of his own like media circus that was this trial of him. He spun this story that he'd only forged art to prove his worth as an artist and that he took a great pleasure in tricking the Nazis. So he twisted his reputation from a traitor into that of like this patriotic hero who was getting over on the Nazis, right? And so he basically told all the Dutch people this story that they wanted to believe because they were feeling so bad about occupation. So Van Meegeren was found guilty of forgery, but he was cheered as he left the courtroom. And he knew how to give people exactly what they wanted, right? Like he died of a heart attack before he served any time, but there was an opinion poll that was conducted shortly like around that time. And he was found to be one of the most popular men in the country at his death. So there's some takeaways from us here. Like, you know, don't be emotional when you're analyzing whatever it is that you're analyzing. Think about, do you have motivated reasoning? And, you know, be very fearful of it. Recognize that others might be playing into your desires and giving you exactly what you want to be hearing. The smarter you are, the more persuasive you can be in talking yourself into something. So you're actually extra dangerous. And then finish it up with a Kahneman quote here, which is overconfidence is the most significant of the cognitive biases. So just check your, you know, check to make sure you're not being too motivated in your reasoning. Don't be over emotional and recognize that it's really easy to be overconfident in what you're looking at.
The other thing I'd add, if I could, is like, I think it's really important when you're asking people, like particularly I'm thinking about expert interviews and whatnot, but same could be said about, I don't know, like if you're trying to figure out why management teams are doing something, like ask the right people for the right stuff. Like if you ask an engineer a question that should be asked to a salesperson, you're probably not going to get a very good answer. So I don't know. I just thought of that because I had interviewed somebody from Guidewire and I didn't ask too many like sales related questions, but I need to. And I need to go back and ask a different person that. But like he was an engineer and I just don't think I don't think he's well suited to answer the questions that I have from the sales stuff. So I don't know. It's interesting. The other thing that I was thinking about with like what games people are playing is, you know, if somebody, I don't know, if somebody has a motivation to flip. So I guess what I'm thinking of is my buddy that was in oil, he was telling me about the games that they used to play and how like they would, how he thinks they would see people that would bid on assets around them to like fake mark their book up and then flip to another person. So it's like really important to think about like who is making the bid, who is telling you the information, what might they be thinking behind? And it's kind of annoying to think that way, but I think you almost have to.
How does that fit into like efficient market theory when you have
people at his level? I think he would argue there was a lot of inefficiency, which is why he, you know, made the money he made and luck, but that was good veggies, Jake.
Thank you.
Yeah, I enjoyed that. It's funny how often those artists are able to sell fakes, get fakes out into the world. There's a few documentaries on Netflix about somebody.
The Koch brothers, didn't he get tricked, or was that wine? That was wine.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That was the wine one as well, wasn't it?
Knockoff wine.
Yeah.
Are they assuming that people don't drink them? Or people don't know when they drink them? Is that the
probably?
You like sell it for 10 years at a minimum. And then 10 years time, you drink whatever it is and you just like, oh, I guess that's a 10-year-old wine.
This tastes like $2 Chuck. It is, sucker.
Except like it's been vinegar. Aged for a year.
What's going on here?
Aged for 10 years.
That's right. It actually tastes like vinegar. That's how you know it's good.
The funny thing is that there are all of those studies. I think I put these in quantitative value where it said, you know, they put MRIs on people's heads when they drink the wine. They're just told this is from a $100 bottle of wine and they drink it. And the pleasure centers of their brain light up more than the same bottle of wine where they're told, oh, this is a $2 bottle of wine.
Yes.
Like they're not lying about their experience. They're genuinely experiencing more pleasure because they think it's a more expensive bottle of wine.
Hmm. That's right. Bad tasting medicine works better.
Yeah.
Bigger pills work better than smaller pills. There's the engineering answer, and then there's often the human answer, and those don't always necessarily go together. Credit to Roy Sutherland and Alchemy for that kind of thinking. He did the best job of really like digging into that.
Yeah. We got about 15 minutes, guys. You want to throw in some questions? One of my highlights from the Future Proof was seeing Steve Romick. What do you guys think of Romick?
Boy, I hope I aged that well.
Yeah, doesn't he look great? Coming up on 60, he said.
Fit individual. Looks like he's just got all his shit together, doesn't he?
Yeah. And he was all over that book too. When he was talking through all the positions in the book. He's well and truly knew them.
Yeah, he knows his companies.
Except I've seen him on cable, so not gonna make it.
He's got some chatter in there, hasn't he?
Yes, he does.
Oh boy.
Bound to die a sad death, but I will die with him.
What's the bull case on charter?
There is none. That's why the stock goes down.
It's very cheap.
Yeah. By the way, the low tick in COVID was 371.70. Today, 365.09.
Is that on the S&P 500? Are we through the...
No, that's charted.
No,
that's
you're,
oh, sorry.
You're calling out
just,
Roman.
Just following up on a question that I had asked.
Do you want to tell that story?
No, I just asked. I said, like, you know, the charter's at the COVID lows. So how do you know you're not wrong?
He asked, like, Steve this in live interview.
Yeah. And I guess there was a debate as to whether or not I was right. But I was pretty right, especially on a buyback adjusted basis. But his answer was correct. He said, you know, you focus on KPIs. And, you know, I think that the bull case on Charter is if you believe in share cannibals and you think that fixed wireless is not a viable answer at scale, and you think that some of the data that's coming out is maybe similar to some of these SaaS companies that are really small and are growing very quickly, but at maturity will not grow that fast or won't grow into their projections, and you think it's hard to overbuild fiber, and you think inflation makes that even harder, and you think interest rates going up also makes that harder, then you own the infrastructure in the ground. But it may not work.
What's the pick?
Levered, so
too much debt, and that wireless is going to overtake.
Yeah, I think like from first principles, it doesn't like if you just think about the way the world should be, like why do we have any wires?
Case in your own tail.
Yeah, this is what she does. You know, I think it's like, well, why isn't everything wired? And that's kind of funny that she's doing this right now.
Yeah, while you're
and like fiber is just a better network, so cable's inferior. I just think there's a lot of things that have to happen.
When you say cable, it's twisted. It's like it's twisted pair copper rather than...
It's a hybrid. Fiber. It's like fiber into the plant, and then it's a coaxial to your house.
When you said that, like that's the hub. So it's not fiber to the home. It's fiber to the node or something like that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's like a head end, and then it comes out. So it's a hybrid infrastructure. So they need to get fiber deeper in, and I guess you got new DOCSIS 4.0 is coming out.
Extremely expensive.
Well, that's certainly what I've always read. So we'll see.
And they've always got, because the tech's always got better, but the coax has always got faster and faster.
Yeah, there's different ways to speed it up. So,
I mean, is the bet really just the world will change slower than what other people might expect?
Yeah, and I think with Charter... I mean, I said it at our thing, I think Comcast is probably actually cheaper and maybe even safer given the balance sheet. But I think the thing that's nice is, you know, exactly what they're going to do with the buyback, money. Right? They're going to continue to retire shares. So shares out have gone down a lot. I don't know. We'll see.
There's some good questions here. I think you guys might be overestimating our powers, but I'll throw them to you guys just in case. Here's one. I wonder if investing in traditional oil stocks has risk that newer shale companies could steal their market share in the future, or are the traditional big guys likely to do most shale too?
Jake?
Yeah. My understanding is that shale is still relatively expensive compared to a lot of traditional old finds. Therefore, it's kind of that marginal. But I mean, the amount of oil that they're able to get out of these things that they couldn't get before is actually like quite astounding.
Out of shale.
Yeah. Like you took from getting like a thimble full to, you know, getting barrels, relatively speaking. And so it's pretty profound, the technology, and quite a boon for humanity. If you want to think that way. Now, I don't know. The adoption, and you know, I'm sure there's some ways that it gets cheaper, as far as you know, a lot of it has to do with actually computer modeling of the geology to try to like find where's the right place to drill and have less dry holes drilled. So you know, that gets cheaper all the time, which is good as an input cost. But I don't know, I just think we're probably going to need I don't think you have to pick between. I just think we're going to need oil for longer than a lot of people would probably prefer. And if that's the case, then there's probably a lot of money to be made over the next 20 years still.
When did the shale bust happen? Was it 2017, 2018?
earlier.
Was it that early?
No.
I would say.
No,
I think it went on.
I think the boom was like 15 and
yeah.
Yeah, I think the bust was like 18 or 19 or.
Yeah.
I could be wrong, but I think we're still pretty close to people remember getting burned on funding shale projects.
It was
which is
that
from closer that to where the capital cycle you want to be investing is after people are burned as opposed to before they get burned.
There was a stat from that period that more money had gone into it than had come back out. Is that still the case, or was that the case?
Shale?
Is that true? Yeah.
Could be. I kind of remember Bethany McLean saying something like that at one point.
Yeah.
She's usually pretty solid. So, yeah, it's, well, you know, blame zero rates. If you're, you don't want to lay like ESG at the feet of the Fed, but there is a little bit of argument there that you probably wouldn't have had as much of that being done if it wasn't such cheap money.
William Kim says the bust was 2015.
Maybe. I don't know. I think it was later.
I think you guys got old timers disease. I think time is passing more rapidly.
It's very possible.
Definitely true.
Aging.
Yeah. Fair.
Definitely true.
That and I just came off of a guy's trip, so my brain may be
a little pickled.
Yeah, like 85%.
How was Chicago, by the way, Jeff? Fun?
Yeah, man, it was super fun. We did some real Chicago stuff, played a lot of bags on a rooftop, had a crazy Airbnb, had a lot of
crazy good.
Yeah, it was wild. It was it was like a lot of pictures of naked females and musicians. It was really weird. I don't know how to describe it. And if you just say it out loud, it sounds weird, but like it was so well done. It was like artistic. Very artistic. Yeah, it was very artistic.
I'm going to need you to send me some pictures.
I'll follow up offline.
Okay, good.
I got another question. I think this is a good one, too. I don't know the answer to this.
Don't you have any easy ones, Toby? Like, what's this freaking...
Not today. I'm only throwing out the stuff that's hard. This week, US inspectors arrived at PwC, KPMG, and Hong Kong for an audit review of US-listed China tech. How will this play out?
I'll let Bill take this easy one.
Right. Well, good, bad, or in between. You're welcome.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
I'm kind of with you. I don't really know. Like I can see there are, I don't know if there's a, yeah, I guess there's a potential for a good outcome where you remove some of the discount that's hanging over that China tech.
Bad. Yeah. I mean, I think like it's so naturally Western to distrust everything. And I think that there's good reasons to distrust some of the accounting, but I mean, I don't know enough to really have an informed opinion. And I'm hopeful that they don't find much. I think it would be good for the world if they don't.
But I agree. With
I have
that.
No idea.
I think the world's a lot better place if China and the US are friendly coexistence. And if we can't find that, and we have these little friction points like accounting as one of them, which seems kind of a weird one to have, but boy, it'd be nice if we could just figure out how to bury the hatchet on some of this stuff and keep good relations up.
How's Charlie doing on his Alibaba position?
I don't know.
I'm just pulling up Alibaba now. I haven't had a look for a little while.
I don't think he's too worried about 90. It.
Yeah, I think that's probably south of what he purchased. What do you think?
It's at 5-year lows or something.
It's hard to purchase lower than a 5-year low.
I'm just having a little bit
when
of trouble.
When you can, you want to do that.
That is exactly what you want to do. If you can purchase below the low, strong.
that's where you want to go. You
definitely want to do that.
Not being able to pull it up.
Give me an easy one, Toby. I need a layup here. What's
all right? Here's one. When will inflation get back under control?
Oh boy,
you son of a bitch.
Let's get back to that China tech one.
Yeah. I mean, you have so many competing factors here. Capitalism wants to solve this problem, and provide us with more for less. Governments like to run deficits, especially when it feels like there aren't consequences. deglobalization maybe as a factor pushing in the not good for inflation direction, if we have to rebuild supply chains and everything is just more expensive, there's more friction in the world than there was, if you kind of believe Peter Zeihan type of arguments. I don't know. These are large gale size forces pushing in both directions. And it's kind of like, which one is stronger is really hard to say.
I actually thought Biden's answer was not that terrible on 60 Minutes, which I'm sure people will laugh at. We're going to do this real quick. Cereal and bakery products up 16.5% year over year. You don't need them. They make you fat. Meats, poultry, fish, and eggs up 10. You need that. That makes you strong. Dairy and related products make you fart 16% higher. Fruits and veggies up 10. Non-alcoholic beverages, you just need to drink water as a collective, action. That's 13. Other food at home, 17. That's our 16.7. That's tough. Energy up 24. I don't see that doing that year on year, but could. Energy services up 19. That's not great. New vehicles up 10. I bet that comes off. Apparel up 5. Probably starts to come down. Although with zero COVID, who knows? Tobacco and smoking up 8.8. You can count on that to go up and maybe higher. Airfare 33%. I don't think that continues. So I don't know. There's some things that I could see coming down.
Housing, though, is such a big component of this. Like, what's that look like? Because that's going to drive a big chunk.
6% yeah, and I'm
year over year for housing costs.
Yeah, that's what they say.
That's the rent equivalent shenanigans.
I think it's rent, and I think it's actually housing. Hang on one sec. Shelter rent of rent of primary residence 6.7, and owner's equivalent rent of residence is 6.3.
See, I got a feeling that's a little muted,
understated
reality, right?
Yeah, yeah, I agree.
So, does that go up or down?
I don't know, man. That's the question that I'm really not sure on. Because if you believe that we have a supply problem, I do think that
over or under supply at this point.
Under, well, I think under generally, but maybe we don't. I mean, maybe the amount of inventory that hits the market comes out, and it really was a bunch of people that just owned Airbnbs. That'd be good for inflation.
I bought some plane tickets back to Australia for the end of the year.
My apologies.
I'll be pushing back retirement about 5 years as a result of that.
Yeah.
How's the second on your house to make that happen?
I was looking at the listings around me, and they have exploded. But the prices that people are asking are out of this, like, they're crazy.
The stat that I saw today was that the median, the cost of service,
median home.
No, that's not, sorry, that's not the stat. The stat was the same payment. I guess it's the median mortgage payment, where a year ago that bought a $550,000 home. Today that buys a $335,000 home, something like that.
Yeah, that sounds right.
So there was another one. U.S. median housing payment as a percentage of median income. This is payment includes property principal, interest, taxes, insurance, PMI. It climbed up to 44.5% per the Atlanta Fed. And it was down in the 28% range in 2020. It was at 42 back in 2006. So wow. It's kind of a little bit of a scary, chart there.
I'm not sure what you take from it, because what I take from that is if you locked in lower rates, you're just not selling your house.
Yeah.
To 30-year mortgage right now, like 6.5% today.
Yeah, it's not that high historically, though, you know?
It's about the long run average, right? That's where it was in 2008 as well. I saw that same stat, I think.
So I think the thing that's tough is if you do think that housing is undersupplied, I don't know where people are going to start selling their homes from. I don't think there's going to be a lot of voluntary, trading a 3% mortgage for a 6% mortgage.
Well, you're just going to like turn it into a rental, right? If you have to
Airbnb. Move.
Yeah. That's actually the Wall Street Journal had that exact article that people, it was one person in California that was
fake
just like,
news.
I'm not selling this. Yeah, that's right.
I'm not selling.
That's it, fellas.
All right, we made it.
Thanks, everybody. We'll be back next week with more doom and gloom. We'll
shout out to the ladies. Keep listening.